Aiden in every mouth that speaks of me, in every heart that loves me. Ransomer, go with me where I travel. Ransomer, lead me where I should go. Ransomer, give me the blessing of your presence, as I give my life to you. As Yarnall finished his silent recitation, the pale monstrosity vanished from the nearest tree beneath the edge of the platform. A moment later, he felt the entire wooden floor dip beneath him as the creature pulled itself up from below. First, its hands appeared, knob-knuckled and black-clawed, each big as a serving platter. Then the head, a white lump that rose until light glinted from the twin moons of its eyes. For all its fearsomeness, Yarnolf thought the monster looked like something put together hurriedly, its elbows and knees and hairy limbs sticking out at strange angles. It moved cautiously as it pulled itself up onto the platform, the timber's belly creaking beneath its great weight. Its foxfire eyes never left the dead woman at the far end of the wooden stand. Yarnolf had seen many giants, had even fought a few and survived, but the superstitious horror never entirely went away. The beast's shaggy, powerful limbs were far longer than his own, but it was old and smaller than most of its kind. In fact, only the giant's legs and arms were full-sized. Its shrunken body and head seemed to dangle between them, like those of some hairy crab or long-legged insect. The Nyahuni's fur was patchy, too. Even by moonlight, Yarnolf could see that its once snowy pelt was mottled with age. But though the beast might be old, he reminded himself, it was still easily capable of killing even a strong man. If those grotesque, clawed hands got a grip on him, they would tear him apart in an instant. The giant was making its way across the platform toward the corpse when Yarnolf spoke, suddenly and loudly.
What do you think you are doing, Nightwalker? By what right do you disturb the dead?
The monster flinched in alarm, and Yarnolf saw its leg muscles bunch in preparation for sudden movement, either battle or escape.
Do not move, corpse-eater, he warned in the Hikadea tongue,
wondering if it could understand him, let alone reply.
I am behind you. Move too quickly for my liking, and you will have my spear through your heart. But know this, if I wanted you dead, godless creature, you would be dead already. All I want is talk. You want talk?
The giant's voice was nothing manlike, more like the rasping of a popinjay from the southern islands, but so deep that Yarnolf could feel it in his ribs and belly. Clearly, though, the stories had been true. Some of the older Hunin could indeed use and understand words, which meant that the terrible risk he was taking had not been completely in vain.
Yes. Turn around, monster. Face me.
Yarnolf couched the butt of his spear between two of the bound logs that formed the platform, then balanced it, so the leaf-shaped spearhead pointed toward the giant's heart like a lodestone.
I know you are thinking you might swing down and escape before I can hurt you badly, but if you do, you will never hear my bargain, and you will also likely not eat tonight. Are you by any chance hungry?
The thing crouched in a jutting tangle of its own arms and legs, like some horribly malformed beggar, and stared at Yarnolf with eyes bright and baleful. The giant's face was cracked and seamed like old leather, its skin much darker than its fur. The monster was indeed old. That was obvious in its every stiff movement, and in the pendulous swing of its belly. But the narrowed eyes and mostly unbroken fangs warned that it was still dangerous.
Hungry, it growled.
Yarnolf gestured at the corpse.
Answer my questions, then you can have your meal.
The thing looked at him with squinting mistrust.
Not Your... This? No. This old woman is not my grandmother or my great-grandmother. I do not even know her name. But I saw her people carry her up here, and I heard them talking. I know that you and your kind have been raiding tree burials all over this part of Rimmer's God, although your own lands are leagues away in the north. The question is, why?
The giant stared fixedly at the spear point, where it stood a few yards from its hairy chest.
I tell what you want, then you kill. Not talk that way. No spear.
Yarnulf slowly lowered the spear to the platform, setting it down well out of even the giant's long reach, but kept his hand close to it.
There. Speak, Devilspawn. I'm waiting for you to tell me why. Why? What, man?
It growled.
Why your kind are suddenly roaming in Rimmersgard again, and so far south. Lands you were scourged from generations ago. What calamity has driven your evil breed down out of the Nornfells?
The corpse giant watched Yarnulf, as carefully as it had watched the spear point, its breath rasping in and out.
What is calamity?
The giant asked at last.
Bad times. Tell me, why are you here? Why have your kind begun to hunt again in the lands of men? And why are the oldest and sickliest Hunin, like you, stealing the mortal dead for your meals? I want to know the answer. Do you understand me? Understand, yes.
The thing nodded, a grotesquely alien gesture from such a beast, and screwed up its face into a puzzle of lines.
Speak your words. Me, yes.
But the creature was hard to understand, its speech made beast-like by those crooked teeth, that inhuman mouth.
Why here? Hungry.
The giant let its grey tongue out and dragged it along the cracked lips, reminding Yarnulf that it would just as happily eat him as the nameless old woman whose open-air tomb this was. Even if it answered his questions, could he really allow this inhuman creature to defile an Aedonite woman's body afterwards? Would that not be a crime against heaven almost as grave as the giant's?
My Lord God, he prayed, grant me wisdom when the time comes. Hungry is not answer enough, giant. Why are your kind coming all the way to Rimmersgard to feed? What is happening back in the north?
At last, as if it had come to a decision, the beast's mouth stretched in what almost seemed a smile, a baring of teeth that looked more warning than welcome.
Yes, we talk. I talk. But first say names. Me.
It thumped its chest with a massive hand.
Bur Yok Kar. Now you. Say. I do not need to tell you my name, creature. If you wish to take my bargain, then give me what I ask. If not, well, our trading will end a different way.
He let his hand fall to the shaft of the spear where it lay beside him. The giant's gleaming eyes flicked to the weapon, then back to his face again.
You ask why, Hojan, why giants come here,
the creature said.
For food. Many mouths hungry now in north, in mountains. Too many mouths. What do you mean, too many mouths?
Igdaja, you call Norns. Too many. North is awake. Hunters are everywhere.
The Norns are hunting your kind? Why?
For fight.
Yarnulf sat back on his heels, trying to understand.
That makes little sense. Why would the Hikadea want to fight with your kind? You giants have always done their bidding.
The thing swung its head from side to side. The face was inhuman, but something burned in the eyes. A greater intelligence than he had first guessed. It reminded Yarnulf of an ape he had once seen. The prize of a Narved merchant who kept it in a cage in the cold courtyard of his house. The beast's eyes had been as human as any man's, and to see it slumped in the corner of its too small prison had been to feel a kind of despair.
Not everything that thinks is a man, Yarnulf had realized then, and he thought it again now.
Not fight with, the giant rasped. They want us fight for. Again.
It took a moment to find the creature's meaning.
Fight for the Norns? Fight against who?
Men. We will fight men.
It showed its teeth.
Your kind.
It was not possible. It could not be true.
What are you talking about? The Hikadea do not have the strength to fight mortals again? They lost almost everything in the Storm King's War, and there are scarcely any of them left.
All that is over. Nothing over. Never over.
The giant wasn't looking at him, though, but was staring raptly at the body of the old woman, thinking again about supper.
I don't believe you, said Yarnulf.
Bur-Yok-Kar turned toward him, and he thought he could see something almost like amusement in the ugly, leathery face. The idea of where he was, what he was doing, and how mad it was, suddenly struck Yarnulf and set his heart racing.
Believe, not believe, not matter, the corpse giant told him. All of North World wakes up. They are everywhere. The Higdaja, the White Ones, they are all awake again, and hungry for war, because she is awake.
She?
Queen with the silver face, awake again.
No. The Queen of the Norns? No, that cannot be.
For a moment, Yarnulf felt as though God himself had leaned down from the heavens and slapped him. In an instant, everything that Father had taught him, all his long-held certainties, were flung into confusion.
You are lying to me, animal.
He was desperate to believe it was so.
Everyone knows the Queen of the Norns has been in a deathly sleep since the Storm King fell. 30 years and more. She will never awaken again.
The giant slowly rose from its crouch, a new light in its eyes.
Bur-Yok-Kar, not lie.
The beast had recognized Yarnulf's momentary loss of attention, and even as he realized it himself, the giant took a step toward him. Although half the length of the treetop platform still separated them, the creature set one of its huge knobbed feet on the head of his spear, pinning it flat against the tethered logs.
Ask again. What name you, little man?
Angry, and more than a little alarmed at his own miscalculation, Yarnulf rose and took a slow step backward, closer to the edge of the platform. He shifted his balance to his back foot.
Name, I have many. Some call me the White Hand.
White Hand?
The giant took another shuffling step toward him, still keeping the spear pinned.
No. In North, we hear of White Hand. Big warrior, great killer, not skinny like you.
The creature made a huffing noise, a kind of grunt. Yanov thought it might be a laugh.
See, you put spear down. Hunter, warrior, never put spear down.
The giant was near enough now that he could smell the stench of the rotting human flesh in its nails and teeth, as well as the odor of the beast itself. A sour tang so fierce it cut through even the stiff, cold wind.
Et young ones like you before.
The corpse giant was grinning now. Its eyes mere slits as it contemplated the pleasure of a live meal.
Soft. Meat come off bones easy.
I am finished with you, godless one. I have learned what I needed to know.
But in truth, Yanov now wanted only to escape, to go somewhere and try to make sense of what the creature had told him. The Norn Queen awake? The Norns preparing for war? Such things simply could not be.
You finish with me?
The huff of amusement again, followed by the carrion stench. Even as the giant leaned toward him, its head still loomed high above Yarnoff's, and he was now within reach of those long, long arms as well. This monster might be old, might have to scavenge its meals from burial platforms, but it still weighed perhaps 3 times what he did, and had him trapped in a high, small place. Yanov took one last step back, feeling with his heel for the edge of the platform. Beyond that was only a long drop through sharp branches to the stony ground.
Not even enough snow to break my fall, he thought. Lord, O Lord, make my arms strong, and my heart steadfast in your name and the name of your son, Osiris the Aedon.
As if reminded of the cold, he adjusted his heavy cloak. The giant paid no attention to this small, insignificant movement. Instead, the great, leering head bent even closer until it was level with his own. Yanov had nowhere to retreat, and the corpse giant knew it. It reached out a massive hand and laid it against the side of Yarnov's face, in a grotesque parody of tenderness. The fingers curled, each as wide as the shaft of the spear that was now so far out of his reach. But Yanov ducked beneath its grasp before it caught at his hair and twisted his head off. Again they stood face to face, man and giant.
White Hand, you say?
With Yarnov's spear pinned to the platform beneath its foot, the beast was in no hurry.
Why they call you that, little Rimmer's man?
You will not understand. Not for a little while yet. I was not born in Rimmersgard at all, but in Nakiga itself.
The cracked lips curled.
You, not Higdaja, you just man. You think Bur-Yok-Kar stupid.
Your problem is not that you are stupid, Yanov said. Your problem is that you are already dead.
Yanov looked down. A moment later, the giant looked down too. Beyond the hilt in Yanov's hand, a few inches of silvery blade caught the starlight. The rest of it was already lodged deep in the monster's stomach.
It is very long, this knife,
Yanov explained as the giant's jaw sagged open.
Long enough that the blood does not stain me, which is why I carry the name White Hand. But my knife is also silent and sharp as the wind. Oh, and cold. Do you feel the cold yet?
With a movement so swift the giant had no time to do more than blink, Yarnolf grabbed the hilt with both hands and yanked upward, dragging the blade from the creature's waist to the bottom of its ribcage, twisting it as he cut. The great beast let out a howl of astonishment and pain and clapped its huge hands over the wound, even as Yanov threw himself past it, still holding fast to the hilt of his long knife. As he tumbled into the center of the platform, the blade slid back out of the beast's hairy stomach, freeing a slide of guts and blood. The monster howled once more, then lifted dripping hands to the distant stars, as if to fault them for letting such a thing happen. By the time it came staggering toward him, innards dangling, Yarnulf had regained his spear. He had no time to turn the long shaft around, so he grabbed it and charged. He rammed the rounded butt end of the shaft into the bloody hole in the giant's midsection, freeing a bellow of agony from the creature that nearly deafened him. The logs beneath them bounced and swayed, and snow pattered down from the laden branches above as the giant thrashed and howled and plucked at the spear shaft. But Yarnulf crouched low and braced himself, then began to push forward, hunched over the spear as its butt end dug deep into the monster's vitals. The corpse giant staggered backward, arms swinging like windmill vanes, mouth a hole that seemed too big for its head. Then it suddenly vanished over the side of the tree burial platform. Yarnulf heard it crashing through the branches as it fell, then a heavy thump as it hit the ground, followed by silence. Yarnulf leaned out, keeping a strong grasp on the edge of the platform. His head felt light, and his muscles were all quivering. The giant lay sprawled at the bottom of the tree in a tangle of overlong limbs. Yarnulf could not make out all of it through the intervening branches, but saw a pool of blackness beneath it, spreading into the mounded snow.
"Careless," he berated himself. "And it almost cost me my life. God cannot be proud of me for that."
But what the thing said had startled him badly. Might the giant have lied? But why? The monster would have no reason to do so. The Silver Queen was awake, it had said, and so the North was coming awake as well. That certainly explained the giants now pushing down into Rimmersgard, as well as rumors Yarnulf had heard of Hicadeia warriors being spotted in places where they had not been seen for years. Certainly the border was as active as he had ever known it, with Nakigar troops and their scouts everywhere. But if the giant had actually spoken the truth, it meant that Yarnulf had been wrong about many important things. He had stepped onto a bridge he thought safe, only to find it cracking beneath him, when it was far too late to turn back.
"So father's murderer is not gone, not lost in the dreamlands, and as good as dead, but alive, and planning for war again. That means everything I have done, the lives I have taken, the terror I have tried to spread among the Hicadeia, has all been pointless. The monster is awake."
Until this moment, Yarnulf had believed he was God's avenger, not just God's, but father's as well. Now he had been proved a fool. He watched from the platform until he was quite sure the giant was dead, and his own limbs had stopped trembling. Then he tossed his spear over the side and began to climb down. The wind was strengthening, bringing snow out of the north. By the time he reached the ground, Yarnulf was dusted in white. He cleaned the blood and offal from his spear, then used his long, achingly sharp knife to cut off the giant's head. He set the monster's head in the crotch of a wide branch near the base of the burial tree, the eyes lifelessly black and stretched wide in their last surprise, the fanged mouth gaping foolishly. He hoped it would serve as a warning to others of its kind to stay away from human settlements, to find some easier forage than the corpses of Rimmersfolk. But just now defending the bodies of dead men and women was not what dominated his thoughts.
"We men beat back the Witch Queen and defeated her."
He spoke only to himself, and so quietly that no other creature heard him, not a bird, not a squirrel.
"If she has truly returned, this time, men like me will destroy her.
But Yarnulf had made promises to himself and God before, and those pledges had now been proved nothing but air.
No. Save your words for fitter things, he told himself, like prayer.
Yarnulf the White Hand tipped the long spear across his shoulder and began walking back to the part of the snowy woods where he had left his horse. 4. Brother Monarchs. As if to crown the entrance of the High King and High Queen, the sun had emerged from behind the morning clouds and was spreading its light generously across the hills of Hernisadark. Even the disk of gold atop the Taig's distant roof glittered like a coin spun into the air, as though the great hall celebrated their arrival as well. Simon was fidgeting with a golden coin of his own. A medallion of unusually large size and uncomfortable edges that held his cloak and was currently rubbing against his neck. His friend the Lord Chamberlain had insisted that he wear it.
Remember, you are the High King and High Queen, said Jeremias, pushing the pin through the heavy cloak with enough force to make the High King wince. I didn't come all this way to see you two looking like beggars.
Then you should have stayed at home, Simon growled.
Waiting had put him out of temper. The hurt on Jeremiah's round face was so profound that Simon almost apologized. But the edge of the medallion was still digging painfully into his jowls, and he resisted the impulse.
I am the Royal Chamberlain in charge of the King's and Queen's household, Jeremiah said stiffly. That household is in Erkinland, Simon pointed out. We are in Hernesteer.
The household is wherever you and the Queen are, Majesties.
Jeremias put a little twist on the last word to make Simon feel it. The King knew it was difficult sometimes for his childhood friend to live happily with the distance that now yawned between them. Even when Jeremias was close enough to breathe on his cheek, as he was doing now.
In the old days, they say old King John would travel from castle to castle for a year before coming back to the hayhold, so you have little to complain about. There. Now please don't fiddle with it. It looks splendid.
Simon stared into the hand mirror one of Jeremiah's servitors held before him.
It looks like I am ready to be buried. The heavens know I couldn't do much else wrapped up like this.
Some might think that was not a very nice joke, his wife told him, frowning. In fact, some might think the king is taking his own bad temper out on everyone except the one who caused it.
Now it was Simon's turn to send a warning look. Neither of them were happy with Hernesteer's King Hugh at this moment. But such things were not to be shared in front of any but the most important advisers.
Enough, Lord Chamberlain, Simon said, gently lifting away Jeremiah's hand as he tried to give the medallion one last burnishing with a kerchief. You are right, and I apologize, I suppose. It looks splendid. I should hope so, said Jeremiah, his face red from effort.
The royal procession slowly climbed the main road through the city of Hernisadark, past waving and cheering Hernesteri, lined up on both sides. Many crowded on overhanging balconies, or even perched precariously on sloping roofs. The houses and shops had been done up in festive style, bright banners and fresh paint, so that sunlight seemed to jump back into the air as soon as it landed, full of new life. Simon and Miriamel rode side by side, as they always did, monarchs together. Not monarch and royal spouse. In the early days, Simon had been the stickler for that distinction. But as the years had rolled past, Miriamel had become increasingly determined to remind people that she herself was the daughter of a king, however blackened his name might now be, and also the grandchild of Prester John, founder of the High King's Ward, that gave them dominion over much of Osten Ard.
You should have come to meet us at the gate, the queen said, in words so quiet only Simon could hear them. I will tell him so myself.
Give him a chance, my dear.
Simon waved his hand at the crowd. You see, he has brought the people out for us. He could not have kept them inside, she said. And why shouldn't he bring them out? We are High King and High Queen. He is only a king himself, because his great-grandfather did my grandfather a favor. So Hernestia kept its crown.
Still, he is a king for all that, and kings have their pride, as do queens.
Do not make it my complaint, Simon.
Her voice was firm, but her look contained love and a little amusement as well as irritation.
You are too kind, and you hate a fight. But there are people, and I suspect Hugh is one of them, who take that for weakness.
Yes, I do hate a fight. Let's not have one now.
He waved to the cheering Hernestia folk again. Near the road, a group of small girls were leaping up and down, waving colored ribbons that curled and snapped like a frayed rainbow.
Look at them. It makes me miss Lilia.
Our granddaughter would be out in the road, trying to lead the procession.
Simon smiled.
Yes, she would.
Miriamel sighed.
Sweet God, give me strength.
She squinted up the road, lined as far as they could see with well-wishes.
We will not reach the Tague until nightfall at this rate.
Patience, my dear, patience. No more for me, thank you.
Count Eolair covered his goblet with his hand and kept it there until the servant had gone away. He would have enjoyed a little more wine, and after a long day in bright sun, after a fortnight of clouds and dark days, he certainly deserved another cup or few. But Eolair's sense for conflict, as trained as the nose of a hunting hound, suggested restraint. Queen Miriamel's and King Simon's Lord Steward, more commonly known as the Hand of the High Throne, did not want a haze of wine slowing his thoughts tonight. The scene itself could scarcely have been more familiar to him, of course. The wooden palace called the Tague had been Eolair's second home for much of the early part of his life, when he had become first a messenger to kings and eventually an esteemed adviser. The atmosphere in the great hall, where ancient wooden carvings of animals and other totems hung from the rafters, was unquestionably festive. The bright colors of the Hernestiri gentry in their best clothes, mingling with the sounds of tipsy laughter and the succulent smell of roast pork. But something was off kilter here. Queen Miriamel and King Simon were out of sorts with the delays and confusions King Hugh had put them through, of course, but Eolair could not help feeling that something deeper and more troubling was going on. A few seats away, Queen Miriamel was being entertained, distracted, she would doubtless have termed it, by Lady Tillith, an attractive widow who was almost certain to become King Hugh's wife. Many at the Hernestiri court thought her too old, nearly 30 years, though her children by her husband, the late Earl of Glenorga, showed that at least she was fertile. In fact, with her handsome, womanly figure, glossy chestnut hair, and high color, Lady Tillith looked a bit like Eolair's idea of the Hernestiri goddess Dianacha, or even Great Mercia herself, the mistress of the rains. The High Queen made a stark contrast to dark Tillith. Miriamel's golden hair was largely silver now, worn in simple plaits under a modest circlet. Her cheeks were pale, her green eyes shadowed, and Eolair was worried for her. This was the first time the king and queen had faced the anniversary of Prince John Joshua's birth while away from home. Eolair did not blame Queen Miriamel in the least for her irritation at being marooned in conversation with King Hugh's mistress. In fact, as Eolair watched, the queen seemed to have lost patience entirely with Tillith's chatter and was trying desperately to draw King Simon's eye. Her husband saw, but Hugh was leaning close to him, talking with quiet animation, and Simon could only shrug to show his helplessness. Ayla shifted on his seat and felt his joints complain at him for sitting too long on a hard bench. He was beginning to wish he had accepted that offer of more wine, if only to ease his old bones. The day seldom passed now that Ayla, once among Hernesteer's best riders and swordsmen, did not marvel at what age had done to him. "I have become time's poppet," he thought sadly. "She plays with me as a child with a doll, pulling off a piece here, another there, dragging me through the mud, then carrying me back to sit at some mock banquet." But this gathering was no child's performance of grown-up ways. It was deadly serious business. The monarch of Hernesteer welcoming his liege lords, the king and queen of Erkinland. Simon and Miriamel ruled over Hugh's Hernesteer and most of the rest of Osten-Ard by the authority of the High King's Ward, the empire that Miriamel's grandfather John of Warrensten had created with his strength and his sword. But even at the best of times, some of the lords of the High Ward's component nations had chafed under John's rule. Ayla could not help wondering whether Hugh was becoming such a man. Or did something else explain his odd behavior in keeping Simon and Miriamel waiting so long outside the city? And even after they rode in, Hugh had waited to meet them until they had reached the Tague itself, which suggested less than perfect subservience on his part. But Hugh had been changeable and headstrong all his life, something Ayla knew better than most. Hugh's father, Prince Gwythyn, had been one of the first to die in the great war that had made Simon and Miriamel monarchs. Gwythyn had been killed and mutilated by renegade Rimmer's men, serving Miriamel's father, King Elias of Erkinland, who had been corrupted by the lying promises of Inaluki the Storm King. Gwythyn's body had been left for his kinsmen to find. When his father, King Luth, had died in battle against the Rimmer's men not long after, only Luth's daughter Maegwin and the king's young wife Inawen had remained to lead their shattered people. Then madness had taken Maegwin, and with her nearly all that remained of Ayla's hope for his native land. The Storm King's attack on the countries of men had failed at last, but in the chaos that followed, the ruined, headless nation of Hernesteer struggled to hold itself together. Over the first few months, a surprising number of nobles asserted slender, if not completely spurious, claims to the throne, and it seemed only civil war would settle their rivalries. Then a sort of miracle occurred. Everyone had been certain that the line of royal blood had ended with Maegwin, until a young woman of the court was pushed forward by her mother and father to tell her tale and show the infant she had been sent off to bear in secret. Prince Gwythyn's bastard. Gwythyn had not married the young woman before his death, but he had made certain promises to care for her, and her family had his ring and letters to prove it. The court was anxious to have a royal family again, so the child's claim was backed by the wiser nobles, not least of whom was Ayla himself, who did not want their suffering nation to tumble into war again so soon. So, in the end, all fell into place for the infant Hugh Upgwithen. When his mother died from a fever a few years later, young Hugh was given to the king's widow Inawen, who did her best both to raise him for kingship and to rule as his regent, with help from Count Ayla whenever he could pull himself away from Simon and Miriamel and the court of the High Ward in Erkinland. And here sat Hugh tonight, Ayla thought, a man now more than 30 years of age, but still with much the look of the changeable, energetic child who had gusted through the Tague like a spring gale, flinging open the shutters. Still the same large round eyes that could look so innocent, so surprised by any accusation. Still the same curling dark hair that would never lie flat, but bounced with every shake of his head, every loud laugh. The round cheeks of his childhood were gone, his handsome face grown thin, but it was still easy for Eolaire to remember the monarch's charming youth. So why did this older Hugh make him so uncomfortable? King Hugh caught him staring.
Eolaire, my noble Eolaire Tarna, better than uncle. Why do you look so downcast? Must I beat the potboy for sloth?
Boy, bring the master of Nad Mullach more wine.
Eolaire smiled.
No, Majesty. I have been amply and regularly served, and your table is splendid. I am only thinking.
Bah!
Thinking? You will sadden us all.
Hugh held high his cup, waiting until the roar of drunken conversation diminished in the high wooden hall.
Instead, we should all rejoice. This is a rare feast indeed, when we are joined by our brother and sister monarchs.
Eolaire saw Miriamel's head lift at the same moment as Simon looked down at the table. Neither of them had failed to notice Hugh's choice of words. As the cheers fell away and people began to wave for their cups to be refilled, the Dowager Queen Inawen rose quietly from her seat. Hugh noticed.
Dear lady, why do you leave us?
I beg forgiveness, Your Majesty, but I feel a bit weak and the wine is too much for my head. I mean the High King and High Queen no disrespect, of course. I am suddenly unwell.
And Arwen didn't look Hugh directly in the eyes, but her shoulders were squared as though she expected some kind of violent response, which seemed odd to Eolaire. If she was not the king's true parent, Inawen was the closest thing that Hugh had.
Ah, then I beg forgiveness myself for putting you through a tiresome evening, dear stepmother.
Hugh smiled. His expression seemed quite ordinary, but Inawen turned her head as though it hurt her to see it.
Not tiresome at all, Majesty, she said.
How could it be in this best and highest of company?
She smiled and inclined her head in a bow towards Simon and Miriamel. But it appeared to Eolaire that the Dowager Queen was having difficulty keeping her lip from trembling.
Please, don't stay on our behalf, Queen Enawen, Simon told her. But we will have a chance to see you before we leave, I hope.
Enawen assured them of it, and made her way down the length of the table. King Hugh now clasped Simon's shoulder, pulling the High King back into conversation. Eolaire took the opportunity to rise and follow Inawen out of the great hall.
Poor, poor queen, said Lady Teleth.
Miriamel was not sure she'd heard correctly.
I beg pardon? The poor Dowager Queen. She does not like these gatherings.
The dark-haired woman laughed.
I do not blame her. They can be tedious. The king loves his company, but some of the older folk at court weary of long evenings.
Miriamel was not so much younger than Inawen that she enjoyed hearing this woman speak of the older folk.
Your queen did much to save this kingdom during the Storm King's War and after it. Of course.
Teleth laughed again, as if it was a little strange anyone should take offense.
All the more reason she should rest now, with Hugh on the throne.
Lady Teleth gave every appearance of being as attractive and stupid as a peacock, but Miriamel could not shake the certainty that something deeper and perhaps darker was going on beneath the surface.
Do not let your petty jealousies get in your way, she chided herself. Think of the wise words of Holy Saint Yistren. God gives us all youth, and then takes it away again. What have you gained to offset that loss? patience, perhaps a little wisdom. Then be patient, and perhaps you'll also be wise.
This banquet was work to be got through, just as much as reviewing the verdicts of the assizes, or examining the exchequer with Passavalles. She did her best to smile, and said,
"Pardon me for being clumsy, Lady Tilleth, but is there not concern still, here in Hernestia, about the succession?"
Tilleth waved her hand at this tiny matter.
"Oh, believe me, Hugh has bastards enough, if the need of an heir arises before he and I have made one."
Miriamel found this young woman more than a little disconcerting.
"You seem unworried. We will conceive. The gods have promised me."
Her eyes, darkly lined in a style Miriamel thought of as almost exclusively southern, showed not a trace of doubt.
"I hope I do not insult you by speaking of my belief in the gods of my own people. Your Adonite piety is well known, even here, in Hernestia."
Miriamel could only shake her head, although she could not help feeling that something less than complimentary had been delivered.
"Of course not. The king and I have never tried to force our own faith on others."
She did her best to smile.
"And of course we pray that heaven will bless you both with a healthy child."
Mary could not help wondering whether the woman was a little mad. Was she really certain that making an heir would be so easy, even with divine help? Miriamel and Simon had only managed one child in all their years together, and that child was dead. Had John Joshua not married while still young, there would be no male heir. The High Ward itself would be in danger, all its nations ready to plunge back into chaos when she and Simon died, as they someday must.
"God grant I go first," she thought suddenly. "I will not have the grace to put up with them all if Simon is gone. He was always the patient one."
Miriamel turned to look for her husband.
"Sometimes too patient."
At the moment, Simon was looking more than a bit like one of the weary old ones himself, smiling stiffly as King Hugh poked and prodded him, the younger monarch prattling on and on about hunting or something else that her husband could not care less about. Put to work in the hayhold steamy kitchens from a young age, Simon had not enjoyed the sporting education most kings received, nor did he much like the noise of belling hounds, and neither did Mary.
"Majesty," Tilleth asked, "have I said something that upset you?"
But the hint of a smile seemed to lurk at the corners of the woman's mouth. Something about this wife-to-be put Miriamel on edge. There was no escaping it. She was suddenly filled with a powerful desire to be anywhere else.
"No, of course not, Lady Tilleth.
It has been a long day, that's all." King Hugh's heavy chair scraped on the floor. Stone flags now, not the strewn rushes of the old days. Despite the ancient carving still hanging in pride of place from the rafters, even the honest old wooden teg was beginning to resemble something different. Perhaps one of the palaces of Naben.
"A toast," Hugh cried. "Let us raise our cups once more before the evening slips away. To our beloved fellow monarchs, who grace us with their company, King Simon and Queen Miriamel."
"King Simon and Queen Miriamel,"
shouted those still sober enough to get names and titles in the right order. The uproar was followed by an expectant silence. Simon looked to his wife, who nodded. He put a hand on the table and hoisted himself to his feet.
"To King Hugh and the throne of Hernestia," Simon said, raising his own cup. "Long may the stag of Herne's house graze in these beautiful meadows. And I hear that the king is soon to be married as well."
He nodded toward Lady Tilleth, who straightened in her seat.
"May the union be
ever blessed. The packed hall echoed to more toasts, more cheers. Something else was needed, but Miriamel tried not to make it too obvious. Accustomed by years of practice, Simon caught her expression, and to her grim satisfaction understood it. "And," he said, silencing the murmur and the returning hum of talk, "I would also like to make one more toast. This is a night of joyful reunion between old allies and meetings with new friends. But as you know, it is not such joyful business alone that brings us here. The Queen and myself are bound for Elvrit's Halle, with the sad task of saying goodbye to a dear friend and a faithful ally, Ducas Grimnor. Raise your cups in his honor, please." "Duke Iskrimnor," many cried. But the response was more muted than to the previous toasts, and Miriamel distinctly heard someone down the table say, "One less Frostbeard." Before she could demand to know who had uttered such a vile remark, Simon caught her eye and shook his head. For a moment she felt almost as much anger toward him as toward the fool who had insulted the dear old duke. But Simon had earned her trust many times over. "Patience," she told herself. "He's right. Not here. Not this evening." She took a breath and did her best to let her fury seep away. Just as wine spilled during the toasting was now soaking into the linen tablecloth, she could not help wondering whether the red stains could ever be completely washed out. He caught up to her in the lower ward outside the great hall. "Queen Anarwen, Highness." Anarwen's maid continued a few discreet steps ahead as her mistress turned. For a moment, Aelair saw not the mature, almost elderly woman who had left the hall, but Anarwen as he had once known her, golden-haired and fair of skin, threatened by shadows all around.
"You honor me, Count Aelair," she said in her Nesteri.
The soft burr of his mother tongue reminded him of several things, not least the ticklishly warm feeling of Anarwen whispering it into his ear, so long ago that it seemed like another life. "Please, lady, in your mouth a title seems something shameful, at least for me. It has been too long, Anarwen. You look well." Her smile did not have much conviction.
"I look like what I am, an old woman, old and in the way."
"Never." But her words struck him. "In the way of what? Do you object to the king's upcoming marriage?" She glanced at her maid, who was pretending to look up at the stars a short distance away, and at the two guards who had accompanied them from the great hall.
"Oh, no. Who could object to the king's happiness? But come to the queen's little house and talk with me a while. I have no wine worth serving you, but there might be a little mead left from the midwinter festivities."
"I have not had proper mead in months. No, 2 years, my good lady, since I was last in Hernisadak. I would be honored." The queen's little house was in truth not so little. A square, three-story structure in the modern style near the outer wall of the Tague. Aelair sat in a deep chair in the parlour, as the maid was dispatched to the kitchen in search of mead.
"I have a bottle here we can start with," said Anarwen, producing a ceramic jug from a sideboard and pouring it into two small glasses of fine workmanship. "It's made from cacoil clover honey."
Aelair took his glass and sniffed it as they settled into chairs by the fireplace. "Lovely. Then what use have we for the other?"
"The use of giving my maid something to do for a few minutes. You asked me a question, I gave you an answer. Did you believe it?"
He was almost amused to see this version of Anarwen. "You have become a plotter, then?"
my dear. What happened to the shy, truthful young woman I once knew?
She gave him a sad look.
You mock me, sir.
No, not at all.
Talk to me, then.
Do you dislike the idea of the king's marriage?
He thought it would not be surprising if Anarwen felt protective toward Hugh, and Telleth was certainly no subservient virgin bride.
Marriage is a necessity. Do you know how many children he has fathered without benefit of one? Seven. Seven that are known. Can you imagine the furor if he died without a chosen heir?
The mere idea of a half-dozen claimants to the Hernesteri throne was enough to make Aelaer's oppressor shudder.
Yes, I think I can. So the marriage will be a good thing, then.
If he wed someone else, it would be.
And although they were alone in the spacious room, she lowered her voice.
But not to that little witch.
Aelaer could not help being startled by the harshness of her words.
She is so bad, then? Or is it her father whose ambitions reach too high? He was a loyal bondsman to King Luth, as I remember.
No. No, her father is trustworthy enough. A fat old gentleman farmer now that his fighting days are past. Fond of meat and drink and bragging about his cattle. He gained much land when he married Telleth to the Earl of Glenorga. It is the daughter herself, Telleth, that I fear.
The Dowager Queen pursed her lips.
She is a witch.
You've used that word twice.
Does it mean more than your dislike? Enarwen looked down at her glass for a moment. The firelight filled the room with long, dark shapes that moved as though in anticipation of something.
I do not know, Aelaer, but I have heard many rumors, and some of them are frightening to me.
What do these rumors say?
If I tell you, you'll be certain my wits are gone.
She shook her head.
Some say Telleth has brought back a very old, very evil worship.
Worship?
He was puzzled.
I am not sure I understand, my lady. Nor would I believe it anyway. You, of all people, should know that kings' favorites often attract ugly tales.
Enarwen grimaced.
Yes, some cruel things were said of me also. But nobody ever accused me of reviving the rituals of the Crow Mother.
Aelaer could scarcely believe he had heard it.
The maker of orphans? The Morrigan?
Even indoors beside a fire, a shiver travelled up his backbone.
Nobody would be so mad. It took Hernesteri hundreds of years to destroy that horrid cult.
Still, that is what I am told, and by those who have no reason to lie to me. They say she has become fascinated with the Dark Mother, and she and some followers try to summon her.
Why?
Aelaer had not thought of Morrigan the Crow Mother in years. No Hernesterman had openly sacrificed to her since before King Tethtane's day, 3 centuries gone. The last of her worshippers, a filthy inbred remnant in the northern deeps of the Kakoil Forest, had been destroyed by Luth's father, King Lithan, long before Aelaer's own parents were born.
Surely not even a self-absorbed creature like Lady Telleth could hope to revive such a fearsome practice, he thought. Why would she do such a mad thing?
How should I know? They say she claims the Morrigan came to her in dreams.
Now that they were sitting by the bright light of the fire, he thought Enarwen looked pale and exhausted.
I hope it is only some passing fashion. Aelaer, the pastime of bored courtiers. But I remember my grandmother's tales of the Morrigan's followers from when she was a girl, how frightened people in her village were, how they would walk a long way to avoid the gaze of one of the Crow Mother's worshippers.
Aelaer felt a pang of uneasiness, but would not show it.
Surely, even if there is any truth to this rumor, Lady Tirith thinks of it only as an amusement, something to shock the Tague's elders. He essayed a smile. Elders like you and me.
Perhaps, said Anarwen, but with no answering cheer. But this I can swear to you, dear Count. Hugh has not been the same since he took up with her. He was always flighty, always changeable. You remember that, surely?
I do indeed. There were many times in his boyhood I wished I could take him across my knee.
I wish you had. I wish someone had. But now, I don't know, Eolair. He has changed, and it frightens me. The way he looks now, as though he has some delicious secret. It is as though she has convinced him of something, something that makes him think he is beyond danger. Surely you can see that. Everything he did today, everything he arranged, was meant to snub the high throne in some way or other. That was not the Hugh I watched grow. That child might have been spoiled, perhaps, headstrong.
She frowned and fell silent. A moment later the maid came in, unsteadily bearing a large jug.
Found it, mistress, she said.
Do you hear that?
Anarwen tried to smile.
Mistress, not even highness any more.
The maid looked stricken.
My apologies, highness, I...
Put it down, child.
Anarwen waved her to set the jug on the low table.
Now take yourself to bed. The Count and I have almost finished our talk. He can let himself out.
The maid nodded and set down her burden before scurrying toward the stairs. Eolair waited until the door closed on the landing.
Is there anything else I should know, or can do?
He reached out and touched the back of Anarwen's hand.
I would see you happier.
Speak to the gods, then.
Only their plans matter, not ours.
He looked at her fondly, at the lines on her once smooth face that told the story of the miseries and the passing moments of happiness. Not enough moments of happiness.
Not enough for either of us, he thought, and certainly not enough that the two of us shared.
During the Great War against the Storm King, both of them had lost someone who could never be replaced. Anarwen, her royal husband, and Eolair, King Luth's daughter, Maegwin. Eolair had not realized how much he cared for brave, bedeviled Maegwin until she was gone. Was he making the same errand now with Anarwen?
There is so little comfort in this world, he thought. Have I been foolish to let duty guide me always? Lady, he began, but she was already shaking her head.
I can guess a little of what you're thinking, my brave Count. There is no use in it. We are what we are. And our roads ran side by side for only a short while. But you will always be dear to me, Eolair.
And you to me, Highness.
He finished his second cup of mead, and felt it in his legs as he stood to return to the great hall.
I will think carefully about the things you've said, and I will do some asking of my own. And rest assured, Queen Miriamel and King Seoman will know your fears.
He bent and kissed her hand with careful attention.
May the gods take good care of you.
Of all of us, dear Eolair.
She finally smiled, but it was a half-hearted thing.
It is so strange to see you with your hair all grey. I cannot even think how I must look to you. Yes, may the gods watch over us closely, because we are all in need of the gods' good care.
5. Awake. She blinked. Soja always blinked when she stepped out of the great Nakiga gates, and her eyes always watered. Freezing winter had imprisoned her under the mountain for months. Even the cloud-smothered white ember that was the northern sun dazzled her to blindness. She signaled to her escort to wait until she could see properly. The household guards halted at a carefully calculated distance, demonstrating both her high status as a magister's property and their own mute indignation at having to protect a mortal, any mortal, even their lord's most valued concubine. When her full sight returned, Soja led the four silent Hikadeya guards down the cracked, discolored stairs onto the field of banners, anciently a place of triumphant celebration, currently the home of the so-called animal market. The air outside the mountain was painfully fresh and cold, but rich with smells from the nearby sacred grove, pine and lemony birch and honey-sweet daphne. Even the reek of the fermented fish, sold from jugs all over the market, was almost welcome, because it reminded her of her old, simple life in Rimmersgard before the Norns took her. And as always, simply being out in the light and air, even surrounded on all sides by her fellow slaves and their corpse-pale overseers, Soja was thinking about freedom. Even though she had conceded long ago that it would never happen, she still dreamed about escape. As she made her way down the untidy rows of mortal vendors and mortal buyers, she stopped to look at some gloves offered for barter on a crumbled stone table, while the woman who had made them squatted beside it to stay out of the wind. In the early years of her captivity, one of Soja's fancies had been to keep hidden a set of cold-weather clothes in case the chance for escape ever actually came. A warm, sturdy pair of fur-lined gloves like this would be much better than the ones she had hidden away, along with the gold coins and clothes and other useful things. But Soja could no longer convince herself that she would leave the mountain, even if she were given the chance. Nezeru's birth had changed all that. She set the gloves back on the stone. The clan Endoya household guards fell in around her once more. The crouching woman did not even look up. The animal market had gained its name because nearly all the buyers and sellers were mortals, and that was how the Hikadeya thought of Soja's kind. The market sprang to life each year during the Wind Child's moon, and came back once each moon during the warm season. Mortal serfs and slaves from the outermost Hikadeya lands came to trade goods with their own kind, both those who lived in the mountain itself and those who sheltered in the new settlements outside it. A tumble-down collection of shelters tossed up in recent years on the bones of Nakiga that was, the long-deserted Hikadeya ruins outside the mountain's gates. Most of those who came to the market were overseers, buying cheap blankets, clothes, and food for both mortal and changeling workers. A few of the more fortunate mortals, like Soja herself, mostly body slaves and other pets of the Hikadeya nobility, came looking for luxuries, scents, drinks, and foodstuffs more suited to their human tastes than what was given to them by their masters. But although most of the goods were meant only for mortal slaves and the poorest Hikadeya, no Norn of any standing would be seen mingling with the human herd. Soja was still constantly reminded that she now lived among the fairies. Mingling with the hundreds and hundreds of mortals and the smaller contingent of armed Norn guards keeping watch over the market were a large number of the only slaves the Norns considered lower than mortal men and women. The changeling Tinukadeya and all their weird variety. There were carrymen, of course, man-like beasts of burden almost as tall as wild giants, with immense muscular shoulders and tiny, empty-faced heads that showed no alteration of expression, even when they stumbled under their monstrous loads. But Tanukadeya came in many other shapes as well, from the small, scuttling, hairy things that worked on the highest mountainside farms in other parts of the Norn Fells, to the slender, mournful-faced delvers, who, despite their spindly appearance, could not just dig faster than either humans or Norns, but also shape stone with the delicate ease of a man carving soft wood. Sodja watched a pair of these delvers with bleak amusement as they bargained almost silently with a gem seller, the owl-eyed creatures flinching hurry to be out of the sun and back into soothing darkness. Was the exact opposite of her own desires. But body shape alone meant nothing, not here. Her Norn captors themselves, although more manlike than any of the changelings, were as different from Sodja as a wildcat from a rabbit. She should have been used to it by now.
How long can you live in such a place and still feel that you are caught in a terrible dream?
But it was an empty question. Because she knew the answer was forever, or at least until she died. Sodja did her best to banish such dire thoughts, so she could enjoy her scant time in the sun, but it was not easy. Pointless as it was, she knew that the dream of escape would never completely leave her. She had spent too many years under the open skies ever to be able to surrender. Still, all she had to do was look around to be reminded of how hopeless such thoughts were. The slave folk never looked up at the Norn guards, and barely raised their voices above a whisper, even when they were bargaining with other mortals. Back in Rimmersgard, where she had lived so many years in such ignorant happiness with Valada Roskva, the Rimmersgard matriarch and healer who had given her a home, the noise of the entire market would have been suitably respectable, from a crowd gathered for a funeral. Even so, inside the mountain that was now and forever her home, so many mortal voices at once would be considered an unbearable, traitorous clamor, and would be quelled by swift violence. So the slaves barely whispered, even out here, beneath open skies.
What good is freedom that cannot be used? She wondered.
Is the poor gift of life worth so much?
But of course, it was not her own life that held her in thrall. And because she had given birth to that beloved life, Sodja knew she was doomed to live and die among a people stranger to her than the beasts of the field, and would never know real peace. Even Sodja's Hikadeya, lord and lover, Vieki, who was unlike his kindred in so many other ways, and who had been more considerate of her than any other of his kind would ever have been, did not understand Sodja's restlessness. The Magister seemed to consider it an endearing but inexplicable mortal oddity, as a child might laugh at a dog chasing its tail, seeing only the low comedy and not the horrible futility. And Vieki was by far the best of them. It took a long time to walk up and down the crooked rows, and snow was beginning to flurry before she had finished. But Sodja was determined to stay in the light as long as possible. The market was large. The site had once been the Norn's Field of Banners, a broad ceremonial ground in front of the mountain gates, last used for its intended purpose centuries past, when most of the north had been ruled by the Hikadeya. The Rimmersmen who had come to Osten-Ard out of the lost west had changed that beyond all recognition, long ages before Sodja had been born. The thick-bearded warriors had conquered all the way down through Erkinland, killing Norns and their Scythi kin in great numbers, and killing countless mortals as well. After the Northmen came, her mistress Roskva had taught her. The Scythi had deserted their old cities and fled to the forests, while the Norns had withdrawn here to their mountain capital and last stronghold, swearing never to give it up, to fight until the last Hikadeya was dead. After living 2 decades amidst these fierce immortals, she did not doubt they would do just that.
And what if war does come again? She could not help wondering. Whose side will I be on? My own people's? Or my daughter's?
The guards were giving her hard looks now. It was clear they thought it time to go back to the mountain, but Sodja knew the weather might turn again, and the deep snows return, which would mean no more outdoor markets for several moons. She ignored their looks and continued to walk up and down the rows, all the way to the market's outermost reaches, bartering builder's order scrip for hazelnuts and cloudberries, dried turnips, parsnips, and wild celery. Even a selection of dried river fish, mostly perch and pike. All of them things that reminded her of her days in Roskva's order, of her happy time as a free woman, now so long ago. At last, as the sun dropped toward the western peaks and the dragon guard began to close the market, she reluctantly signaled to her escorts that she was ready to return.
If I had a basket big enough, I would take back a piece of the sun. Then I think I could put up with anything.
She wouldn't even need much of it to take with her, she told herself. Her life in the mountain would last barely a fraction of her master's, though he was her elder by centuries. She often wondered if any of the immortals would remember her after she was gone, any more than they might recall a single fallen leaf.
But what of Nezeru? Will my daughter, who may live almost as long as her father, still remember me when hundreds of years have passed? And what of Vieki? Will a great lord like him recall that he once loved a mortal? Why stumble on when the end will be the same? Darkness and silence.
The sun had dipped. The outer city and marketplace were growing so cold that her own vaporous breath obscured her sight. She shivered. It was past time to return, and she dared not make Vieki unhappy with her. Not even her death was hers to choose, because she had given a hostage to fate, her only child. Back inside, then, to the quiet, endless halls of stone. Back to the incomprehensible rituals, the masked faces, and the constant knowledge that even after giving birth to a praised young warrior, Sodja herself was still considered scarcely more than a beast.
Ah, beautiful, brave Nezeru, my child, she thought. Though you cannot understand me, and though you despise my mortal weaknesses, I love you still, for you I will go on living in the dark.
Did she love Vieki, her daughter's father, too? Was there something more in her feelings for her many-centuried master, her owner, than mere gratitude to someone who had allowed her freedoms that few of her fellow slaves enjoyed, who had shown her real kindness, and even what seemed like tenderness, as unusual as that was among the Hikadeya? Sodja had no answer for that. She bade a grudging farewell to the sun, then turned back toward the tall, forbidding mountain gates. But in a small act of rebellion, she made her Hikadeya guards carry the things she had chosen for herself. Deep inside the mountain, Vieki Se Endoya, Queen's High Magister of the Order of Builders, was reading in his garden, lingering over a poem by Shunyasu.
As the silence of birds just before dawn, so the silence of the living heart just before death. Then comes the light. Silence, yes, Vieki thought. Before death, it is indeed a rich gift. Afterward, though, it will be freely available even to the poorest of us.
Shunyasu's poetry had been important to Vieki's master Yarike, the former High Magister of the Order of Builders. This volume had been the old noble's favorite book, a gift to Vieki from his own hand. And reading the words almost brought Yarike Seikijana back to stand over him once more, austere, but with moments of sudden humor, yet always full of secrets. Vieki, like most of his people,
valued silence. But it was not what he loved best about his garden. The district of noble compounds on Nakiga's second tier was already quiet but for the occasional shuffle of servants' feet, or the muted clatter of a troop of armored guards on patrol. His house was already a refuge from noisy surroundings. It was not silence, but solitude that Vieki coveted. By the standards of the city inside the mountain, the High Magister's garden was both luxurious and vast, as befitted the leader of one of the most important orders. A shaft led straight up from the chamber's rocky roof, all the way through the mountain's stony hide, and out to the sky by way of an angled entrance in Nakiga's icy flanks that allowed sunlight to bounce down its polished sides and create a single bright column at the center of the garden chamber. At this season, meltwater splashed continuously from a crevice in the garden wall into the rectangular pond, luring birds in from the outside sky. On a good day like today, as many as a half dozen mountain sparrows and a few black and white choughs might be splashing in the shallows, shaking out their feathers and calling back and forth in creaky voices barely louder than a whisper. Even the birds of Nakiga seemed in perpetual mourning. He heard another sound now, softer even than the birds' gentle calls, an intake of breath. Vieki, recognizing his secretary Yemon by that sound alone, carefully slipped the book of poetry he had been reading under his other book, the traditional magister's copy of The Five Fingers of the Queen's Hand. Yemon seemed loyal to Vieki, but he would have been a fool to seem anything else, and Shunyasu's poems had long been forbidden by the palace. Although Vieki's copy of The Color of Water had been given to him by his master, Yarike, who was considered a great hero, it was still unwise for anyone to see Vieki reading it, or any other book that the Queen's Hamaka clan considered suspect. Especially now. Especially today.
I interrupt you, master.
Yemon did not sound particularly apologetic, more as though he secretly hoped it were true. Vieki looked up, mirroring Yemon's rigorously empty expression with his own.
Not at all. Tell me your errand.
Small, stolid Yemon was an excellent secretary, clever and observant, and without any close family of his own to distract him from duty. He was also ambitious, and almost certainly planned on replacing his master Vieki someday, as was true of any but the dullest underlings in every royal order in Nakiga. It would have been foolish for his master to expect anything else, but there was no need for Vieki to hasten Yamon's advancement by being caught with a copy of Shunyasu. He risked a brief downward glance to make sure the forbidden book was not visible.
Your appointed time at the palace is at evening bell, master,
Yemon reminded him. Although they both knew Vieki would sooner forget his own name than a summons from the mother of the people.
Shall I have the litter ready in the hour before, or do you wish to leave the house sooner than that? I will not need the litter. I will walk.
He did not have to see him to know that Yemon had infinitesimally raised an eyebrow, as he always did when his master did something he thought oddly sentimental or foolish. A hair's breadth movement, as telling as a hiss of contempt.
Indeed, High Magister, I will have the guards ready an hour before the bell. Thank you, Yemon. You may go.
Queen Utuku's summons, of course, was the reason Vieki had gone searching for solitude, and why he had been tempted into taking out the forbidden book. Although the poet was long, long dead, Shunyasu of Blue Spirit Peak had written in sorrowful yet dancing words of just such moments as this, of trying to choose between perfect duty and the importunities of conscience. Vieki had stood atop such high and frightening places before, but he had never learned to like them.
This time his dilemma was a simple one, at least in its root. Fieki had been summoned to the highest honor any Hikadea could have, a meeting with Queen Utuku, the immortal ruler of his people and mother of the race. But he did not want to go. In fact, the High Magister had to admit to himself he was afraid. The messenger had arrived at the door only an hour before with the summons to the royal palace. It would be his first time waiting on the queen since she had awakened from the deep, decades-long sleep called Ketayindra, and also his first time meeting her since he had been elevated to High Magister of the Builders. The thought of the coming audience filled him with dread, in part because his loyalty to his old master Yarike meant that Vieki had kept secrets even from the palace itself. Vieki had made difficult decisions during the years of the queen's sleep, always trying to do what was best for his monarch and his people, but he knew as well as anyone that good faith and good intentions were no defense against the queen's unhappiness. The pits in the field of the nameless were full of the scorched bones of those who had meant well but failed to please her. He sighed and called out for a servant. Moments later, a bent older Hikadeya, whose name Vieki always had difficulty remembering, crept in on silent, bare feet.
"Please remind Lady Kemabu that I am called to attend the queen herself at the evening bell. May she reign over us always,"
Fieki told him.
"I do not know when I will return, because I will be at the disposal of the mother of all. So please, give my wife my most sincere regrets and bid her dine without me."
The servant bowed and withdrew. The interruptions had long ago sent the birds swooping back up the shaft, so the pond was again still. For a moment, Vieki hoped he might calm his thoughts once more and tried to find a measure of peace. But the garden now seemed corrupted, the shaft of falling light too harshly bright, the pond too shallow, as though the darkness that had been lurking in his heart since the summons now touched his eyes and ears as well.
"Why do I fear the one who has given us so much? What is wrong with me that I cannot unreservedly love and trust our queen, who protects us against a world that hates us?"
Vieki could find no answer to that. He stood, straightened his clothing, and went in search of his mortal concubine, hoping that she had returned by now from the market outside the gates. As they lay naked in her narrow bed, the great stone bell in the distant Temple of Martyrs tolled once for the mid-hour.
"I must rise again," said Vieki.
"I look forward to that."
"Don't be wicked, Soja. I am called to the queen."
But he did not wish to leave her embrace. Her warm skin against his seemed a sort of magic that defeated worry. How strange, he thought, that this mortal slave, this savage, short-lived creature from despised Rimasgard, should be able to bring him peace when nothing and no one else could.
"Then you must go, of course," she said. "Surely you won't refuse?"
"Refuse?"
Vieki almost laughed, but the surprise of it was like a stumble while walking on a thin bridge above an abyss. Even to be amused was to be reminded of the depths that yawned beneath him.
"I know you are ignorant of many things, little mortal, but any other of my people would strike you for that. Refuse the queen. I might as well tear my heart out of my breast and step on it."
"But surely you have nothing to fear from her, my great lord. While she slept, you had done everything she would wish and done it well."
Soja sat up a little, resting on one elbow, and her breasts settled against his arm. Vieki reached out and let his finger trail across them. How innocent she was, and how little she knew of the thorny tangle that was life in the queen's service.
Even I have done my part, she said brightly. Did I not provide her with a warrior for our great order of sacrifice?